Broadcasting on 103.2, this is Dublin City FM. And all that is now, and all that is gone, and all that's to come, and everything under the sun is in tune, and the sun is eclipsed by the moon.
Hello, and welcome. Yes. Hello and welcome to the Astronomy Show here on 103.2 Dublin City FM with John Dixon and myself, Ben Emmett. Good evening, John.
And a very good evening to you, Ben. Hi, everybody.
Hi, everyone, indeed. As ever, our email address is astronomy@dublincityfm.ie and the text and WhatsApp number is 087-179-1032. That's 087-179-1032. And you can also catch us live on the internet at dublincityfm.ie and also as a podcast. Lots to get through as usual. Coming up Sunday, by the way, total lunar eclipse. We'll get into that, but it's going to be as the moon rises here in Dublin about 8 o'clock on Saturday evening. It's when more or less coincides with when the totality ends, but it still will be a very deep penumbral eclipse. But more on that later. We'll start with what to see in the sky over the coming week, apart from the partial solar eclipse, which of course by definition has to coincide with a full moon.
That's the way it works. Yeah, indeed. Anyway, good evening, everyone. International Space Station back in our evening skies on September the 10th, so not too long to wait now, only another 8 days or so, and it will be in our evening skies until September the 28th.
Mind you, if you're up at 4:40 a.m. tomorrow morning, you'll see it. It is doing a series of morning passes at the moment, but very unsociable hours, so we'll wait. So most of us, I think, will wait until the 10th.
No, I tend to get up and I'll have a little story for you now in a minute.
Oh.
Yeah, Mercury sinks in the glow of sunrise this week. Jupiter and Venus high above it helpfully point its location. So just remember those, Jupiter and Venus. Venus is the brightest. I saw it over the weekend as well. Pretty bright. I'm talking about 3:30 in the morning, so not too far away from watching ISS thingies flying across the sky. Venus and Jupiter shine in the east before and during dawn. They blaze at magnitudes -3.9 and -2.0, which are quite bright still. As I say, Venus is the brighter one. And they're in an area of the sky called Cancer and Gemini, respectively. And Jupiter is the one on the top. Mars, it's a weak magnitude +1.6, so is seeable. Binoculars will help in this case because it's not that easy to see, but you do notice the orangey glow, and that's the very one. And don't confuse, of course, Mars's orange with the brighter, whiter Spica to its left. So just watch out for the little orangey glow in the sky. Saturn +0.7. Again, it's dim. It rises due east in twilight. It's to the lower right of this great square of Pegasus, which stands on the corner, diamond fashion, if you're familiar with that area of the sky. And the best time to observe Saturn with a telescope is after midnight, when it's high in the south. And we see Saturn rings almost edge on this year. As I say, I prefer to see them with that little bit of an angle on them. Not straight on. But the rings themselves are only maybe maximum 10 meters deep, which is remarkable that we can see them from this distance away.
Even edge on,
Even
it's
edge
like
on.
It's like a little cocktail stick going through the planet.
It really is. It's the strangest thing. Uranus and Neptune, these are the two difficult ones to see. They're in Taurus. Near the Pleiades cluster, and Neptune is another telescope object at magnitude 7.8, so it's really dim. And it lurks about 2 degrees north of Saturn. So the ones to watch really in the early hours of the morning, Venus and Jupiter, they're the brightest ones just a moment. But things change week by week, so we'll keep you informed on everything that's happening there.
Indeed we will. Thank you, John. And we mentioned the moon. And at the moment, we have a 74% waxing gibbous moon. It is currently up and on view. Actually, it rose just over 1 hour ago. And it will be due south when it's at its highest at 9:20 this evening. And then when it sets just after midnight, just before, half hour after midnight, and it'll rise again tomorrow, Wednesday the 3rd, just before 7 p.m., when at that stage it'll be up to an 82% waxing gibbous phase as we head towards the full corn moon on Sunday the 7th, when it'll be partially eclipsed as it rises here. More on that and on. Maybe we'll cover it now, actually. Yes, on Sunday the 7th, there will be a total lunar eclipse. The partial eclipse will be visible as the moon rises at 7:57 p.m. That's the time here in Dublin. The partial eclipse ends at just before 9 p.m. and the penumbral eclipse carries on for another hour or so and ends just before 10 p.m. So if you want to get a good look at it, the further east you go, the earlier it will rise, and also if you can get at a high altitude, well, let's say high altitude, but as far as I know, there will be people in places like Haute and the summit of the car park, car park summit, waiting for the moon to rise. Hopefully all we need is a clear sky, of course.
Yeah.
I won't be there, unfortunately. I won't even be in the country, but that's another story. So as you know, John, on the moon, it's a full moon, so normally when you see a full moon rising, being a full moon, it will be very bright. But of course, this will be partially eclipsed because it will be essentially passing through the shadow that the Earth casts from the sun. So instead of seeing the usual very bright full moon, it'll be very dark. Well, I wouldn't say very dark or dim. And it'll be, they're usually around maybe orangey-reddy colour. That depends a lot on what type of particles and material we have in the upper atmosphere. Actually, it might be quite dark this year. I'm just speculating now because of a lot of forest fires around at the moment in Spain and on the continent and in Canada. So there'll be a lot of those particles scattering the light, and that would tend to make it redder. But we'll see. Well, I won't see. As I said, I won't be around. But So check out your local astronomy club. I'm sure I'd be very surprised if they're not having public viewings. And just to let you know, also on Monday in the evening, that object to the lower right of the moon, 3 degrees to the lower right of the moon, that's Saturn. Now, 3 degrees is about the width of your fingertip or two fingertips at arm's length. Then we have, of course, the sun that rises tomorrow in Dublin at 7:38 a.m., 12 minutes later than a week ago, and local noon when the sun is due south and at its highest, that's at 1:24 p.m. and will set at 8:09, which is 16 minutes earlier than a week ago. And then we have a civil twilight until 8:45 p.m., nautical twilight until 9:29 p.m., and astronomical twilight ending and nighttime officially beginning at 10:19 p.m. And that's 23 minutes earlier than a week ago. So you notice that the times between each stages of twilight is between twilight and astronomical night. That timeline now is quite short. It's less than 2 hours now. So, and that's because we're coming up to the equinox. Mm-hmm. When the sun goes, when it's rising and setting, it comes up at basically 90 degrees on the horizon, due east. None of this, it's during the summer and the winter near the solstice, it kind of rises and sets at an angle with respect to the earth or the horizon, but it's time of the year at the equinox, it'll just go straight down. Mm-hmm. So that's why the twilights are quite short.
Yeah, and just back to my story.
Oh, yes,
yeah, tell me. Which was 3:30 Friday evening, or Friday into Saturday morning. And you just mentioned it's astronomical is the darkest one, isn't it?
Astronomical night, yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it was
sun is 18 degrees or more below the horizon.
It's the 6, 12, 18 degree rule for all the different twilights and nauticals and astronomical. But I just happened to be around at 3:30 in the morning outside because it was extremely clear where we were. And looking straight up, we had Cassiopeia vertical. And from that, you just come down a little bit from the two end and over a little bit. And I could actually see Andromeda with the naked eye, with extremely dark.
With the naked eye.
I know exactly where it is. Especially when the sky.
I have looked and I think. I'm not sure whether I imagine it because I wanted to see it with the naked eye. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure my eyesight is good enough.
Yeah, you can catch it in the peripheral more than directly. Yes. And that's where you get to see it with a lot of the galaxies and things like that as well. And it was fascinating because the sky was extremely dark. No moon to blot out any of the stars. And for the first time this year, I got a chance to see Cassiopeia and Andromeda just off to the lower right. And as I say, I know exactly where it is because there's two little pointer stars, and one off to the left, and Andromeda is just off to the right. And it's getting closer to us year by year.
A star map or our little book will tell you. Or a planisphere. Yeah. So I'm not sure whether I have seen it with the naked eye, or whether I kind of convinced myself that I saw it. Because I wanted to.
I'll wake you up one of these evenings.
An atomic bomb doesn't wake me up.
Yeah, there we go. Now, something exciting as well for tomorrow morning, tomorrow at lunchtime, which is a real pity because 1456 GMT, there is an asteroid called 2025 QD8, and it's expected to pass roughly 135,465 miles away from our planet, which is half the distance roughly between us and the moon, which is 57% of there. So it's a telescopic viewing thing. You won't get to see it during the day, but it is going to pass. And I will just mention as well, it's traveling at 28,000 miles per hour at the moment, according to NASA, from their near-Earth object studies. And it's known as 2025 QD8, just in case you want to know. And it's about 71 feet in diameter. And coming pretty close. 136,000 miles is pretty close. Ooh. Yeah, they're also looking at another house-sized space rock spanning around 58 feet, also speeding towards Earth tomorrow as well, joined by a 35-foot diameter asteroid expected to get within 500,000 miles of our planet. So they are up there, and no threats to us at the moment. And they're pretty good now in the predictions of when we're going to see the next one that might be close to Earth. And I think 2032 is the next one. And this particular one, I can't remember my name now. It's the one that's it's going to elude us because it's coming in from a different trajectory than the normal asteroid belt. And I'll get the name for you now in a few minutes. So there we go. So lots of fun. If you have a telescope and you're willing to stay up, I suppose you really need to get to dark, but you will get to see it. So the peak point is just after lunchtime. That's 14:56 tomorrow at GMT, that is. And 136,000 miles per hour. Mm. And travelling at 28,000 miles per hour. And it will move quite quickly. So with a bit of luck, somebody somewhere will be able to see that.
Thank you, John. That's a good segue, I think, into a planned mission. Well, it's hasn't been cast in stone yet, but I know ESA and the Japanese Aerospace Exploration Agency, that's JAXA, they're thinking about and talking about and planning a joint mission to the asteroid Apophis, which will pass Earth in the year 2029. This is the one a few years ago we thought might have a slight chance of colliding with the Earth, but some studies and more number crunching since then has determined that it won't crash into us, thank goodness. This proposed mission is called the Rapid Apophis Mission for Safety, for Space Safety, or RAMSES. And Apophis is a 375-meter asteroid, and what they want to do is monitor how the Earth's gravity alters its physical state during the flyby. And they say, the scientists, that they expect the close passage to provide unique insights into planetary defense strategy. Now, ESA intends to, they hope to get approval November this year with a launch date of 2028, but they're going ahead with some preparatory work. on the proviso, on the assumption, I suppose, or the hope that they will get that approval. And JAXA have also requested formal government funding from the Japanese government for that. And they will include the Japanese contributions, include the spacecraft, solar arrays, the infrared imaging system, and what they say, the use of a H3 launch vehicle for this rideshare project. So they have, the CESA and JAXA have collaborated before on the HERA mission, which was, that's H-E-R-A, that was ESA's first planetary defense mission. Well, it's currently actually en route to the asteroid Didymos. And so they're talking about and hope to plan another one. So let's see and hope that they succeed.
Yeah, you're a man that likes a little bit of cosmology, or has been known, but a team of physicists are arguing that one of the biggest taboos in cosmology, asking what existed before the Big Bang. Nobody seems to be able to give us an answer to this.
That would be an ecumenical matter.
Well, it can now be approached by using numerical relativity. And in a new paper published in Living Reviews of Relativity, Eugene Lim of King's College London, together with Katie Clough in Queen Mary University of London and a few others, describe how computer simulations can extend Einstein's equations into extreme conditions where analytic methods fail. It's remarkable, isn't it? They just have this language of doing this. So what has happened before that? So as we remember, Einstein's general relativity describes gravity, but when applied to the earliest universe or black hole singularities, the equations just simply break down. So cosmologists usually assume the universe is homogeneous and isotropic, simplifying calculations but limiting exploration of more complex scenarios. Numerical relativity allows you to explore regions away from the lamppost. Gee, there you go. Referring to the tendency to stick to solvable but overly simplified conditions. So they just still have absolutely no idea. And they just argue with each other and say, this is how it happened. This is what is it? Of course, we had inflation. We had the rapid expansion of the early universe, and explains its large-scale uniformity. Well, what is in behind that? And what happened before that? One of these days, we will find out somewhere.
Thank you, John. That's another good segue for me, because I went speaking of cosmology and dark matter. I see there's a facility being built deep within the French Alps. I think it's about 2 kilometres, maybe not quite 2 kilometres down, but there's a plan to search for that elusive dark matter. And it's an international team, and they have developed a different type of sensor to detect dark matter. Now, dark matter has never been detected, but we assume it exists because its presence would explain certain aspects, physical aspects of the universe, especially galactic rotation and things like that, why galaxies don't fall apart. And it's reckoned that because there's a lot of matter in there, which has a gravitational force, and that's keeping the galaxies together and not, when they spin around, as you know, the Milano has spiral arms, but they seem to stay together. But anyway, it is reckoned that about 85% of the universe is made up of dark matter, but it hasn't been found yet. And some of the traditional dark matter detectors rely on things like xenon or argon to catch attempting to catch recoils from weakly interacting massive particles, or WIMPs.
WIMPs.
W-I-M-P-S.
Yeah.
Weakly interacting massive particles. But these people think, well, maybe because these WIMPs are not so massive, maybe they're smaller, maybe they're wimpier than WIMPs. So they're detecting anew. Or they have developed new detectors, which they hope will detect this dark matter. And it will be 2 kilometers underground in the French Alps, and it's surrounded by the thick rocks surrounds it, or it protects it from cosmic rays. And they've also have layers of lead and copper to reduce background radiation. And they just say they're trying to lock in on dark matter signal is like trying to hear somebody whisper in a stadium full of people.
Yeah. News now on SpaceX. It set a record with the 30th flight featuring the Falcon 9 booster known as B1067. That was just last Thursday from the Kennedy Space Center. The Starlink mission 1011 placed another 28 satellites, Starlink satellites, that is, into Earth orbit and the low one. More than 1,800 of these satellites have now been launched across 74 missions in 2025. Is there room for anything else up there? They say that there is. The booster landed its 30th landing coming down at sea. I watched this. It actually just dropped straight into the sea and all you can see was steam coming out of it. So it's remarkable. And it came back about 8.5 minutes after launch. So the previous missions for B1067 were 18 batches of Starlink satellites, 2 astronaut flights, 2 cargo missions to the International Space Station, and booster 1067s also aided the 500 Falcon 9 flight to date on July the 2nd. So it's remarkable how things just rack up. And the amount of stuff that they put into the low Earth orbit. Now, a lot of this stuff does come back down again.
Eventually. Which brings us nicely to SpaceX Starship Mega Rocket, which we discussed over the last few weeks. And they did actually have a successful launch last Tuesday. That was its 10th test flight and seemed to go pretty well. So the rocket's 123 metres tall, which is just slightly taller than the Spar. And it's the most powerful launch vehicle ever built. And a few minutes into the launch, the first stage booster, known as a Super Heavy, that splashed down in the Gulf of Mexico. But they decided not to use their chopsticks, arms to catch the booster as it landed. And then when they started looking at the upper stage, which was one day, well, they hope to use it to carry crew and cargo. And it was the first time that SpaceX was able to deploy 8 dummy Starlink International satellites on board. And they had a little video camera which you could see with this little machine, like a little robot, pushing them out one at a time. Some of the heat tiles did fall off, but they say they had kind of planned that because they were testing it. And one of the other things they want to do is actually have reusable heat shields. They did note that it took 9 months to refurnish the space shuttle's heat shield between flights. But Mr. Musk, of course, wants to use to be able to turn them around in a day, to have the design such that you can reuse heat shields. Wants to reuse everything, which is fair enough, but they're still a bit behind schedule, and it looks like they will be, you know, it's going to be tight for that lunar landing in 2027. And he also plans to send an uncrewed Starship to Mars next year.
Yeah, which will be something to watch as well when the time comes round. Now, what do our friends in the International Space Station eat? All sorts of stuff that we don't know about, and it needs meticulous preparation in the microgravity environment aboard this International Space Station. Foods are vacuum sealed, the utensils are magnetic, and spoons or fork are tethered down to prevent them from floating away, which is not a good idea, especially if can you pass the salt, please? I suppose through your and past your ear and out the other end as well. So
I think they have their salt and pepper in basically suspended in oil, because take up salt, a normal salt cellar, like we do,
shake,
a shake, or they just go everywhere,
or a grind,
because of the lack of gravity. So they have it in, but I'm not sure. You still can't pour it out of there.
No, it's really strange. If you watch any of the videos on anything that's in space through NASA, it's fascinating topics for all the stuff that they do. But at the moment, they're into sushi. Yep, this is what they're doing. They use their creativity and culture to make life in orbit feel a little more like home. So, despite these constraints, astronauts on the ISS use their creativity to prepare some familiar and favourite dishes, making them feel more at home. So they've rice, spam, fish, crackers and condiments to help them along that way into eating sushi. And I quite like sushi, actually.
Not bad. You can take it or leave it.
And there's another plate version that they use, included sushi with seaweed, rice, tuna and spam that adhered to stuck to the plate, yeah. And thanks to its moisture creating surface tension, that's where your pass the salt, please. You squirt out a blob and just catch it with a plate.
So I see, right.
Yeah, so it's served inside the galley if the International Space Station's Unity mode, should I say. So why is it amazing? Believe it or not, space sushi has been a popular choice aboard the ISS for more than a decade now at this stage. In February 2010, Japanese astronaut Soichi Noguchi brought raw seafood and shared it with his crewmates. Isn't that nice?
Very nice.
Otherwise, he wouldn't have been able to go to sleep. He'd just sneak up into the night, nick all his sushi and stuff. Anyway, it's fantastic.
Sharing is caring.
It's caring indeed,
of course. Meanwhile, I was going to say a little nearer home, but I see some new seismic evidence suggests that the interior of Mars is far from the smooth image that we often think about, and that instead the planet's mantle, that's the part of the planet that's below the crust being on the outer layer, and then the mantle beneath that's littered with ancient fragments, some of them up to 4 kilometres wide, which are formed during some early collisions more than 4.5 billion years ago when the planet was being formed. So how did they find this out? Basically, some seismic data collected by NASA's InSight lander shows that the waves, those seismic waves that they generated, passed through the Mars mantle, encountered interference consistent with a heterogeneous structure. And the researchers likened the interior to a rocky road brownie containing diverse chunks of material trapped when the young planet cooled. So basically you have the inside of the planet looking like a rocky road. Those are different textures and densities of material. And they reckon a lot of that was caused by these massive impacts as the planet was forming, and which generated huge oceans of magma, and then cooled and left it in the current condition that it's in. And unlike Earth, where we have the tectonic plate activity, which kind of returns and recirculates and recycles the crust of the planet, that didn't happen on Mars because that cooled much quicker. So we have a frozen in time, this image or this data, or a planet which has not changed from that point of view in the past since it was 100 million years or so. So yeah, there are a lot more research to be done there.
Yeah, something that caught my eye just before we disappear. The historic astronomical observatories in Ireland, how many are there?
Historical? We were talking about Sligo and Dunsink and Blackrock, and that's three, and Birr is four.
Birr is one of them, yeah, but the ones that we really talk about are the Armagh Observatory. Then we have Dunsink, of course, which we know very well. And the Birr one, which has this radio telescope, although it had a huge big beast. What's the Leviathan or something?
The Leviathan, yes. From the days of...
There are a few more, I think, around of the newer varieties, as you mentioned, one in Sligo.
McCree Castle something like up that, way.
And I think I'm still due a trip up to the Planetarium in Armagh.
We've been threatening that for so long now.
We just haven't done it yet. So and we know people.
We do. I think we can get there on our own back too.
I know, I think so. You just book online, so anyway.
We'll do that. Yeah, they have a great planetarium and different shows and different, and some for kids and some for not.
Kids.
Yes, indeed. Thanks, John, for your news and for driving the sound this evening. But that's all for me, Ben M, from this edition of The Astronomy Show. It's music all the way now until 2 a.m. here on 103.2 Dublin City FM. Because up next, we have Dublin's greatest hits. And from 10 p.m. till midnight, Nigel Wood has his ear to the globe. And from midnight till 2 a.m., Dave Barry has his mix of jazz, blues and soul. But please join myself and John.
Just John. Me. Yes. I nearly forgot.
Yeah. He's joining John at the same time, 7:30 p.m. next week. He will be back with all the latest news from all corners and dimensions of the universe. Until then, take care of each other. Thank you for listening. Say goodnight, John.
Goodnight, John.
Goodnight, John.
Broadcasting on 103.2, this is Dublin City FM.